Hey, it's Christine from Storyworthy. Today on the show, comedian Namur talks about performing stand-up comedy in Saudi Arabia.
If you want to do a public show in Saudi Arabia, singing or anything, the crowds are going to be segregated. That means women will be separated from men. So you'll have a room that is divided down the middle with a blocked wall so that they don't see one another. And the women will be on one side, the men will be on the other. And the interesting thing about that, obviously, is it creates a bit of an awkward crowd situation when you divide it. Also, it's very shitty.
Man, that is shitty. What else happened?
Just before the show's about to begin, I'm sitting backstage. The promoter bursts in the back door, and he says, there's a car outside. Get in and head straight for the airport because the religious police are about to come in.
Today on Storyworthy, comedian Namur talks about stand-up comedy and politics in the Middle East. Stay close.
Hi, Mako Nimeru. I'm Tismao Storyworthy.
Welcome to Storyworthy. My name is Christine Blackburn, and I'm coming to you from Los Angeles, California. I'm so glad you guys tuned in today. Whether you're a longtime fan of the show or a new listener, welcome to Storyworthy. I hope you guys enjoyed the story last week with comedian Tony Tripoli and his stories about celebrities. You'd think that you really can't lose when you talk about celebrity stories, you know what I mean? Like, you just, it's sort of, it just has a buzz in the title. Celebrity stories. I don't know why we're fascinated with celebrities, but we are. Tony's been working in show business for a long, long time, and he was Joan Rivers' head writer for several years. And anyway, he's just seen a lot and done a lot, and he always has a funny take on celebrities. So go back, you guys, and listen to that. But not today. Not today, because I am here with Nimr Abu Nassar. Did I say that right?
You nailed it.
See, I nailed that. And I knew that. Here's what I know. Nimr means tiger.
Yes, it does.
Thank you.
How did you know
ladies
that?
Ladies and gentlemen.
That's impressive.
Because Christine Blackburn does a little something called
research.
Pre-production.
Pre-production.
That's exactly right. And Nimr is such an interesting guy, you guys. He is a comedian and he is from Lebanon.
Yes,
so
ma'am.
That's something that, you know, we don't. I don't have those guests in as often as I'd like. That's my point.
I would imagine.
Yeah.
It's a bit of a trip.
Yeah, the Lebanese is, it's a small country, I'll tell you that. And it's right there on the Mediterranean, south of Turkey. And you know what it's very close to is Cyprus.
Yes.
And Cyprus, I have some friends from Cyprus, and looking at a map, I was thinking to myself, well, look at that. Those guys are right there.
Yep.
And I believe that Lebanon is more like Arab light, as it were.
Oh my goodness. Lebanon is more like... If you were going to put the word Arab in it, it would be Arab light. The concept of what an Arab is doesn't apply to most of the Middle East, and it definitely doesn't apply to Lebanon. Lebanon's very European. It's closer to Cyprus than it would be to Saudi Arabia, if you will.
Yeah, and Catholic. There
are Catholics there. I'm Christian myself. There's Muslims, there's Jews, but they're all very American, European.
Yeah.
You know, and it's not like... It's very funny when I take a look at the news here and I see how we're depicted. I'm like, my goodness.
Yeah, that's the
mark is. I mean, you know, Elton John's going to be in Lebanon on December 10. Sia was just there. Red Hot Chili Peppers were just there. Like it's very much
it's westernized.
It's been called the Paris of the Middle East before the Civil War. That was maybe 40, 50 years ago. It still really applies now. It's very, you know. Like
it's
Upper East Side, Manhattan, cosmopolitan.
Yeah, it's cosmopolitan.
But it's also Mediterranean. It's on the coast, and then there are mountains, and it's very beautiful. It's stunning.
I bet. I bet. All right, so I'm excited to talk to you about that. And your story, of course, is called Comedy in the Middle East. And I have a couple of stories that I've shared with my audience about my romp through the Middle East.
Mm.
But the thing is like I was on a cruise ship. Like in between places. Do you know what I mean?
So you didn't really...
Yeah. I mean, I was in India for a few days. I was in Mumbai for a few days.
Mm-hmm.
But then on a cruise to Oman.
Okay.
And then in Oman for a couple of days. And that was...
Oman's very beautiful.
Very beautiful.
Very beautiful.
A big Storyworthy fan there. Shout out to Venkat.
Boom.
I met him over there in the Sikh market.
The souk.
The souk market. Exactly. I met him there in the souk market. And it was unbelievable. He goes, we were on Facebook, and I said, well, what will you be wearing? And he goes, don't worry, I'll find you. And I said, okay, well, I have blonde hair. And he goes, I'll find you. So anyway, he represents my Oman constituency.
Nice. Shout out.
Fantastic.
Shout out.
And then I was up in Abu Dhabi, and then mm-hmm. in Dubai for a couple of
the
days.
Emirates,
but yeah, but that, you know, it wasn't like, I mean, it was and it wasn't. Like, for instance, when we were, let's see, south in Oman, mm-hmm. near Yemen, I believe it mm-hmm. is, pretty mm-hmm. far down there.
Yeah.
That was somewhat intimidating.
Yeah.
You know, and we had gotten off this ship and we're on our own, and now we have to go to the airport and get, you know, up to Dubai, so we have to fly. And so, you know, it's a tiny little airport and mm-hmm. only, you know, one gate, and we're the only people who are not Arab.
Mm-hmm. Well, you're in that where they dropped you off is very funny. That's definitely not the mainland.
No, they only drop off like employees.
Like
there,
employees
because
there.
My friend was an employee.
Oh,
on the
there
ship.
You go.
Exactly.
There you go. Because the main airport,
a comedian, right? Yeah,
okay.
On the, ship.
The main Omani airport is one of the most advanced in the world.
Interesting.
So they'll have, you know, it depends on. That's the thing about the Middle East. There's many flavors to it.
Yeah.
If you want to get the terrorist flavor, it happens to be very, very minuscule and in very, very specific parts.
Yeah.
So the which everybody thinks is actually the entire Middle East. If you want to get the actual flavor of the Middle East,
it's more like Istanbul.
It's a lot more. It's much better than Istanbul. If you've been to Istanbul, and I mean in terms of hospitality, in terms of warmth of the people, in terms of everywhere you go, it's a cultural thing. You know, people open up their homes. It's very much like living, you know, the saying where you say, live every day like it's your last.
Mm-hmm.
The Middle East, it kind of applies because for many generations, they did live their last day as if it truly was their last. So they do have a joie de vivre that you won't find in many other places.
That was a little French, wasn't it?
Yes.
See, interesting, because Lebanon was...
We speak English, Arabic, and French.
...colonized by the French.
The French.
Look at that. Interesting.
Who, with their penchant for not being warmongers, did a pretty good job. I mean, they colonized, hung out for a while, and then peacefully left. And we're just like, hey, do you mind continuously teaching French? We're like, sure, no problem. Whereas when you take a look at the territories that Britain had neighboring us, when they left, it turned into a disaster. Namely, when you're talking Palestine then, mm-hmm. and now Israel and all that stuff. So it becomes, the French thing actually ended up working out good for us. Although conventional wisdom would be maybe British would have been more of an empire, but I think for that fact that the French are more susceptible to surrender, mm-hmm. it kind of gave us an easy way out.
But back up to what you were talking about, that sort of attitude that they have. It's sort of an island attitude, right? Mm-hmm. Like, don't worry about it. We'll do it tomorrow. Is that what you're talking about? That sort of attitude?
Well, there's that. That attitude it's different, actually. It's not don't worry about it. We'll do it till tomorrow. It's don't worry about it. Let's see if we live till tomorrow.
See, because the thing with that, I find, at least I took another trip through Greece mm-hmm. a couple of years ago, and you know, there's like so much environmentally not protected, and they just don't seem to care, you know. So there's a lot of litter. There's a lot
in
of
Greece?
You know, Greece, yeah, sure.
Oh, I didn't know.
On a lot of the beaches mm-hmm. and just, you know, I mean, like cigarette butts, beer bottles, and things that they
general
don't even,
pollution.
General pollution that they think like, well, you know what? Don't worry about it. You know, the banks are failing. We do have other things to worry about. So it's sort of a tough.
That for me is surprising. I wouldn't imagine that Greece was like that.
Well, no, there's beautiful parts.
No, no, I know. I'm just surprised because Cyprus is so clean and they're so close to one another. Lebanon, unfortunately, because we had 35 years of brutal, brutal, incredibly brutal civil war, where a majority of the population was displaced.
And had to leave, right?
Had to leave. Hundreds of thousands were killed. There was no regulation for so long that the ability for us to bring back and make the country completely clean and enforced has taken a lot of effort. Huge progress has been made. There are still places where you will find stuff littered, but I would say if you were to compare it to 10 years ago, it's mm-hmm. revolutionary.
That's amazing.
Especially recently, the amount of corruption that goes down there. Recently, our government wasn't able to pick up the trash anymore because they couldn't decide on which trash company was going to take the trash picking up. Therefore, who's going to make the commission off of that? So the citizens actually took it upon themselves and organized, mobilized, picked up the trash, started recycling, started doing. So you have a very powerful nation of people that's kind of bogged down and handicapped by a very powerful puppet government installation that's installed by many different governments around the world. So we have to do the best we can with what's given to us.
Right. But also the population is very young.
So incredibly.
That's a huge reason. 50% under 25.
Yeah. Which is amazing. Which is why we're making
change
such strides.
Coming. Yeah. Change is coming.
It's actually the first country in the Middle East now where being homosexual isn't illegal.
Wow.
That was passed a few months ago. Mm-hmm. But it's been practiced for many, many years. People are openly gay in Lebanon. There hasn't been many problems. But before you get that legal confirmation, it's still an issue. And that happened. The only country in the Middle East now where there are animal rights laws.
Wow.
The only country in the Middle East where everybody's equally represented. It's a democracy.
Well, you know, now they're driving. Women are driving in Saudi Arabia.
That's
what's
ridiculous.
Next?
But
finally.
Once again, if you're saying women are driving in Saudi Arabia, that's like saying... in America, you just reached Mars. It's enormously.
Yeah, I understand.
But it's so sad that that's enormously revolutionary. But for somebody who's been to Saudi Arabia, and today our story, I'm going to talk about that, and seeing the people there, people need to understand when I say a very powerful nation ruled by a very powerful government, that's the problem. Even in Saudi Arabia, the kingdom is not in sync with the people.
Mm.
The majority of the population in Saudi Arabia is also under the age of 20, the majority of them are English speaking. The majority of them are westernized. So,
why do they execute so many people over there? Like every other day, somebody's executed in Saudi Arabia.
Well, in Saudi Arabia, they run under Sharia law.
I see.
But the Sharia law that they run under isn't what Americans fear Sharia law is. It's actually a much more extreme version of Sharia law. Saudi Arabia has a very extremist version of Islam. And the reason that that is because when you say Saudi Arabia, the reason it's called Saudi Arabia is it belongs to the kingdom of Al Saud, the household family of Al Saud. Mm-hmm. And there's many tribes. It's think kingdom. And for them to keep the power, to keep things stable, they can't move radically forward. And if they move radically forward, they could upset and cause a revolution. In Saudi Arabia, what they've done now by appointing a new person to take over power when the current king deceased, and that new person is a very young man. He's the one who set the Vision 2020, 2030, I believe it's called, where he wants to really make Saudi Arabia a touristic destination.
Mm.
For a country that doesn't have cinemas, that's a huge, bold statement. They empowered him, and he's marching forward. I can only wish him the best, but he has a monumental task. You need to understand, that's like going into Alabama and saying, we're going to remove guns. It's not going to happen very easily.
Wow.
Do you get it? And I'm saying, like, literally, think about going into the most, I don't know, think about going to San Francisco and saying, gays are illegal.
Mm-hmm.
If you're going to do that, maybe you can, but it's not going to be easy. That's how monumental the task is to modernize basic, decent human rights in Saudi Arabia is. But this is a country that about 30, 40 years ago was just sand. So people need to understand that Saudi Arabia is developing quickly. And by the way, I'm not defending it. There is no defense of the way they treat the citizens. But you have to understand the reality of the situation.
You know, it is so desert that there's not even a river in that country.
No.
It's like, right? Is that true?
I'm not 100% sure, but I would imagine there isn't. It's man-made probably. It's a desert. It's desert.
It's so desert.
It's very desert. But it has oil.
Yeah, a lot of oil.
And that's the end of the story. I've been saying for many years as a joke that the reason things don't move forward quickly in any country is if there's no need to. When oil prices dropped and the revenue started to decrease and the country stopped being as rich, they realized, and oil is going to continue to drop, and as more electric cars and stuff get in power, it's going to change. They realized they needed different sources of income. They needed tourism. Saudi Arabia was so isolated, it was able to practice an extreme version of Islam simply because they didn't, I mean, nobody told them they couldn't.
Yeah, there and everybody, was no outside
they have
voices.
Hundreds and billions and billions and billions of cash reserves. Why would they change?
Do whatever they want.
I mean, why would they change? And America, definitely, I mean, we just saw president dancing with them and previous presidents have danced with them. Nobody's ever given them any
grief.
Problems.
Right.
So why change?
Right.
And what's the argument for change? Why would we want to destabilize this? Everybody has healthcare. Everybody's taken care of. That was the case.
Right.
Now that they are forced to create different revenue streams, they take a look across and they see Dubai thriving as an economic hub. And then they say, why not us? So that's what they're
doing.
And
amazing.
Because they're doing that, they're having
to change. I could talk to you forever. You know, Nimr, also, this is part of this is the internet, right?
Mm-hmm.
Isn't it?
Oh, of course. The internet changing. Everything. You know, if you're a hijabi lady,
now you see who's been told
that this is that women who aren't veiled are satanic cult worshipping whores. And then you go online and you see a bunch of women who aren't veiled who are actually pretty not satanic cult worshipping whores. It becomes harder to make that argument.
Right.
The internet's fantastic. It's really changed everything.
Boy, oh boy, this is so exciting. You have already given me and my story-worthy listeners such an education. Remember, honestly, we generally don't get this much education. So thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
And we're gonna get to your story in just a second.
Sure thing.
But before we get to Nimmer's story, I did want to remind you guys to head over to storyworthypodcast.com and join my mailing list. Would you do that? Yes, you would. Thank you. I appreciate that. And don't forget to subscribe to Storyworthy on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, wherever you guys listen to your shows. And by subscribing, you really do give me your support, and I need that, so thank you. Mm-hmm. All right, you guys. Nimmer is a Lebanese-American stand-up comedian who is credited with establishing and pioneering the stand-up comedy scene throughout the Middle East. Now, I know you guys thought he was a college professor and that, you know, he was going to lecture us today on politics in the Middle East, but no, in fact, he's going to entertain us. Somehow we're going to turn this around. Now, along with numerous television credits in the Middle East, Nimmer has appeared on CNN and The Nightly Show with Larry Wilmore. I miss that show.
I do too.
I liked Larry very much so. And you were also featured on the cover of Rolling Stone magazine in the Middle East edition, which mm-hmm. is really a sweet, sweet picture of you. It's really adorable.
Thank you. My sister took it.
Nuh-uh, did she?
Yeah, she's a fashion photographer.
Oh, she did a great job.
Didn't she?
So much movement.
I'm so proud of it.
It's beautiful, yeah. Don't forget to check out Nimmer's brand new comedy special over on Showtime. It just started early in October here. And if you guys are in LA, you'll frequently see Nimmer over at the Laugh Factory. Mm-hmm. You can also find him at nimmercomedy.com. It's nemrcomedy.com and on Twitter at nimmercomedy, nemrcomedy. All right, you guys, wherever you are, put your hands together for Nimmer.
So today I'm going to tell a story about something that happened to me. As you mentioned, I set up the stand-up comedy industry in the Middle East. So that involved, it started in Beirut, which is a very open and progressive area, very easy. A lot of the population in Lebanon has been displaced by war. So like me, I grew up in San Diego. And then when I was 11 years old, I went back to Lebanon after the Civil War was done. And all of my friends didn't speak any Arabic. I had friends from Australia, from Canada, from America, from England. Starting doing stand-up comedy in Beirut, not that insane of a proposition. People were familiar with the medium. And as it got popular in Beirut and I started to spread it to Jordan and Oman and other places, we eventually came to the eventuality that Saudi Arabia was next on the list. Saudi Arabia, as we mentioned a bit earlier, isn't the most progressive of countries. And I hope they do better, and they're trying. The thing with Saudi Arabia when we wanted to do shows there is if you want to do a public show in Saudi Arabia, singing or anything, I mean, usually that's pretty much all that you could do, the crowds are going to be segregated. That means women will be separated from men. So you'll have a room that is divided down the middle with a blocked wall so that they don't see one another, and the women will be on one side, the men will be on the other. And the interesting thing about that, obviously, is it creates a bit of a awkward crowd situation when you divide it. Also, it's very shitty in general. So as a progressive human being, as somebody who wants everybody to enjoy each other's presence and is appalled by segregating men and women in a way that makes women feel marginalized. If it was the other way around, maybe not that big of a deal. But since you've got these women being treated like they're objects that are to be feared, there's so many things that are wrong with that approach. I refuse to do a comedy show under those circumstances. So the only option was, we got to do a show without the permission of the kingdom. An illegal show. So there were promoters that like-minded over there. And we started working together. And we would do shows that we couldn't advertise. So they would be on, you know, grounds like a consulate ground or a golf course or something owned by the American embassy or the American school or the Italian consulate. And that would be technically foreign ground. So you could do whatever you want there. So theoretically, you're doing a show, a foreign show. If you're not marketing it, people who are showing up there aren't going to be Saudi, quote unquote. So that was the way we would hide behind it. The thing is, though, Saudi Arabia has an incredibly huge, educated, culturally in touch population. So even though we weren't marketing this and it was just on the low, you know, just by me posting something through a text to somebody, it would just circulate. We did our first show there and about 3,000 people showed up, the majority of which, I'd say about 95% were Saudi Arabian. And I remember the first show we did there, this is a testament to how amazing the Saudi people are. It was on the American, on an American school, I believe. We had to park the cars outside and then pass kind of like a security checkpoint and then walk towards the international quote-unquote grounds. I remember we parked and I was walking in complete silence with, you know, maybe 1,000 of the crowd as the crowd was arriving. And we're making our way to the school grounds and it's just complete silence. The women are veiled and they're with their male sponsors because women couldn't drive. And they can today. I mean, like in the past couple of weeks, we've learned that they're now going to try to make it that women can drive in Saudi Arabia. So congratulations. But at the time, the male sponsors, these would be their brothers or their cousins or their husbands who were driving. And they're with them and nobody's talking. Nobody's mingling. And it's kind of self-segregated. As soon as we got to that ground that was kind of like the foreign ground and we touched our feet there, it was a freaking celebration. You know, like veils came off. And the women, by the way, the Saudi Arabian women are some of the most beautiful, gorgeous, and sophisticated women you'll ever meet. They're heroic with what they put up and how they circumvent a lot of it. Just they're genius. And the men and people started hugging each other. And that was the first show I did there. It went on for about 3 hours because I just couldn't get off because they just were so addicted to the ability to be sitting with each other, to be enjoying a show together. For them, it was like the greatest thing ever. And I don't think I was particularly that funny. I remember in the beginning, I didn't even say a joke. I told a guy, "What's your name?" And he told me his name was, I think it was Omar. And I was like, "Omar, my man with the master plan." I don't even know why I said it. I think I was doing something about rap earlier. And I said, "My man with the master plan." The laughter response to that, it's not even a joke. Just like, oh, just people almost killing each other laughing. And I remember at the, I'm like, are they making fun of me? Like for the first 2 minutes, I was like, what are they making fun of me? Like, it took about 20 minutes for everybody to kind of calm down to normalcy just because of the excitement. So, and that's what the Saudi Arabian people are. And I really hope that my comedy special that people go and see, they'll start to see that Arab crowd that I have, because I'm just going to selflessly plug, but it does fit into this narrative. I filmed this special in Los Angeles and Beirut. And they're Muslim people, they're Jewish people, they're Christian people, both in Los Angeles and Beirut. And I think if people watch this special, they'll start to see what the Middle East is really like and realize that they've been heavily lied to. Now, back to the story, Saudi Arabia, we do this for a couple of years. It starts to catch on. More and more people start to do these illegal shows. And promoters start to get emboldened. Then the BBC comes in. And the BBC comes in and they decide they want to run a story on the quote-unquote underground comedy scene in Saudi Arabia that is in defiance of the kingdom. It's not in defiance of the kingdom. It's not political. I don't do any political material when I go to a foreign country. It's not my place. I'm American or Lebanese. If I'm outside those two countries, I'm not going to talk about your politics. Who am I? So, or religion, nothing controversial. And they run the story. They sensationalize the hell out of it. They have these cameras like they're hidden, although there was no need. And now they've turned the kingdom's eye onto this thing. A week later, I have an event. We get there. My promoter is a bit nervous. What's wrong? The BBC story is out. We just found out that they released it. This isn't good. I said, let's just continue with the show and we'll see what happens. Just before the show's about to begin, I'm sitting backstage. The promoter bursts in the back door and he says, there's a car outside. Get in and head straight for the airport because the religious police are about to come in. Now, this is something else that is now illegal in Saudi Arabia since the new kingdom changes were made. There used to be a thing called the religious police. The religious police were highly uneducated barbarians who had the authority of the kingdom to walk around, and if they saw a woman, I remember once I was in a mall and I accidentally bumped into a woman. It really was on accident. Like, you know, you brush your shoulder with somebody as it's a crowded, and she made an enormous scene. Started screaming and shouting. And I remember being like, what the hell? Like, relax. And then my friend told me she has to do that. Because if she doesn't, the religious police, if they see that, they'll accuse her of, quote unquote, enjoying it, and then we'll beat her. So you can be beaten, you can be imprisoned, flogged, man or woman. It's not just a woman. Literally, men. If a guy does something stupid, religious police has the authority of the kingdom. If they get into that venue everybody who's there is screwed. I'll probably disappear for a while because I'm American. I'll probably reappear. Some other people might not be so lucky. We might have situations where they have people that they're going to humiliate just by putting pictures like they were here, and then they come from prominent families, and it'll cause a huge scandal. So obviously that was unacceptable to me. So I told the promoter, absolutely not. Where are they? And he said, they're outside at the door. They're literally coming in. I said, okay, I got this. I was wearing a suit for the show, and I had my headphones with me, earphones. I snapped one of the earphones off, leaving it just one earphone to a wire, put it in my ear, wrapped it around my ear, and put it through my collar. And I ran outside in full authority and put on the thickest American accent that I could. And there were these three religious police there speaking in Arabic that I could fluently understand, although it's very Bedouin, it's very tribal, but I knew what they were saying. And they were asking what's going on inside. And they're arguing with security because security, it's a foreign ground, you're not allowed inside. But they are. So it's just a matter of time before they can make it in. So I run out and I tell them, excuse me, is there a problem? How can I help? Authority. And as I'm saying that, and he's replying, I put my hand up to his mouth and I tell him to be quiet for a second. I put my hand to my ear and I say, yes, I'm with them right now. Tell Ambassador Smith not to worry. Ambassador Smith was the American ambassador to Saudi Arabia. He was nowhere near the venue. There was no ambassador. So I turn around to the guy and I go, and all he says is, Ambassador Smith? Because for him, it's like he just heard that I'm like, yes, the American ambassador is inside. We understand that there is a security situation. Thank you for telling us. We're going to evacuate him immediately. And the guy's like, no. Like, because if this happens and we cause an incident with the American ambassador, they're screwed. Because when it's going to be public, and then the king is going to come in and say, what did you do to the American ambassador? That's a huge no-no. Saudi Arabia will treat Americans better than it will treat other Arabs. So you have to be very careful here. So I'm like, what's going on? The guy's like, no, it's okay, everything fine. And I'm like, no, I need to understand what's going on. And then I just put it back to my ear, and I'm like, we need to get Ambassador Smith out immediately. And I'm like, thank you very much. And they were running after me, begging me, like, no, don't. It's totally fine in Arabic. I'm like, I can't understand. Why are you shouting? This is worse than I thought. And then the guy, finally, the security guy who spoke both English and Saudi came in as the translator, even though I could understand. But I think he was privy to what was going on. So he comes up and he starts translating and he says that they're asking just what event is going on. And I replied with, I'm security detail. It's none of my business. All I know is that it's a private event for Ambassador Smith and it's a very important evening for him. So they translate that and he goes, okay, who's organizing the event? And I said, and my promoter, by the way, was still sitting next to me sweating bullets. British guy, by the way. And I go, oh, that's easy. So I turn to him and I say, I'm going to give them the promoter details. And his face turned multiple shades of white. And before he could protest, I gave him the details of the people who organized the BBC documentary. And they went on their way. And then we continued the show. And it nobody really knows about that story. Nobody in the show knew about that story, nothing. But it was just one of the many, many hundreds of circumstances that we've had to deal with while we pioneered the comedy scene in the Middle East to kind of move it past hurdles. We've dealt with many roadblocks. We've dealt with stuff. The show went on. It was a 1,500 venue, packed out. People had the time of their lives. And in a small way, I hope that did contribute to emboldening people who wanted to go more progressive in Saudi Arabia.
Oh, I bet it did. I bet it did. Absolutely. How many people went on stage that night?
Oh, it was just me.
For 3 hours.
No, the first show was 3 hours because it was the first time something like that had happened in Saudi Arabia. And they just kept asking for an encore. That time it was a short. It was like almost 2 hours.
That's still a lot of stage time.
Yeah, I know. I had to develop a comedy that would last that long because there was never any. I never done comedy shows with other comics. There weren't any other comics. I was the only comic in the whole region. So every time I do a show, it would have to be at least 2.5 hours because, or else people wouldn't show up. Because Arabs were like, wait, I pay $40 to see one man on stage. I can pay $40 to see six people if there's a band. Yeah. You know, at the beginning, before they knew what stand-up was, it was like, why would I pay the same ticket price for just one guy? He doesn't have any violins or anything. Like, there's nothing.
Yeah, where's your tricks?
Where's the pizzazz?
That is so crazy. Yeah,
it was.
So where'd you get that confidence then? You had to be so quick on your feet to just see that situation and you know, kind of play that security authority guy, rip apart your cell phone, you know, your earphone, your earbud, throw in your ear, and then pretend like, you know, you're talking into your watch, you know, like you're talking, you know, like, you know, go for Namur.
Yeah, right. Eagle zero.
Yeah.
Look, it's very simple. Take a look at your parents. I'm sure at some point in time, your parents did something very selflessly and very quickly on their feet to help their child. If not you, somebody you know. The comedy was my child. So knowing at that moment that if they got into that show, it would literally have ended.
It would stop. So 1,500 people would be.
Not just the 1,500 people. Yeah. The whole scene would have died.
Yeah.
I mean, all the progress we've made, what was infuriating was every few years we would make incredible progress. Then somebody who is greedy, saw money opportunities, or somebody who just wanted to advance their own career with a sensational story would create a potential destruction of everything we've built.
Wow.
And by the way, I built this with not just me. It's not about me. I mean, these are thousands and thousands of people who risked reputations, lives, spent their money, invested to help grow this.
So tell me about who are some of the other people? Can you name some of the other people who are still there making that scene happen? I mean, you still go over.
And right now in Saudi Arabia, it's now legal to do shows.
Okay.
So now I just did the first ever show. I was so happy to go back to do this about 6 months ago, or maybe 5 months ago, in Jeddah and Riyadh, where we had mixed crowds.
Riyadh is the capital? Wait.
I believe so, yes.
So now
naming names would mean nothing because now everybody can. Now it's.
I see.
And now it's changed. But once again, you have to sign a paper before you go in. And I signed one where I said, no politics, no religion, which is fine because I don't do that. And then they said no partial nudity. So I remember joking with the guy from the kingdom, and I said no partial. So full nudity is fine. And I laughed, and he gave me the look of death, and I was like, I see you don't have a sense of humor. So I just signed it.
And you do your comedy in English, right?
Yes, of course.
Well, does everybody over there not?
No, I mean, what's beautiful is in the past 3 or 4 years, Arabic stand-up comedy has started to pop up. And I think that's wonderful.
Yeah, of course.
Because when I started doing stand-up comedy, it was for the art form. I thought, listen, you're kidding yourself if you don't think there's a lot of reasons for you to be angry in the Middle East. I mean, go to America, go to Detroit, go to Chicago, go to Los Angeles, go anywhere, and you're going to see, even in the good places, youth get angry, right? They want to rebel. They want to.
Sure.
So imagine being in Saudi Arabia or Jordan or whatever, and Lebanon, and there's a lot to want to rebel against. But there's nowhere there's no avenue for
there's
you.
There's no outlet.
No, there's no outlet.
Dancing. There's a lot of dancing.
There's a lot of partying. There's a lot of dancing. Right. But there's a lot of passionate flailing. But there isn't anyone who's actually focusing and honing their descent into something that's positive. Stand-up comedy is the ideal revolutionary art form.
Yeah, because it's so truthful and
It's so truthful.
But it's also very. It's also very, very bold, and it takes a lot of. It takes a lot of courage. Not because people are. I don't think because people are afraid to not be funny, but they're afraid to be honest. And public speaking. Not everybody wants to do that, obviously. And then to public speak about yourself is also not so easy. So there's, you know. Many different things have to damage you in childhood for then you to turn around and make you want to go on stage to get that approval. So what happened to you? Anything?
No. For me, it was kind of like I just loved stand-up comedy. I came from a very healthy damage. I wasn't damaged by anything immediate. It wasn't like family abuse, broken home, anything like that. It was things around me. And I had a very strong nucleus, supportive family, all that. But like when I was 5, we came to America when I was 2. And very dark time. We fled.
Because you had to leave. Yeah.
We left. We didn't flee as refugees. We fled as immigrants. But we fled not when we fled.
Yeah, you had to leave.
We had to leave. We didn't go like, hey, America looks cool. Let's head over there.
There
we went like,
war.
Holy
We're
shit,
gone.
It's getting close to us. Now let's bounce. My parents were totally unhappy. Not because America was bad, but because they left their family. You know, you leave everything you know.
Of course, your culture.
Your culture. And, you know, once again, they're European in mind, so it wasn't that much of a departure. It's just, you know, you turn on the news and the area you lived in just blew up and you're here in America.
Yeah.
It just, you won't really understand it until you feel it.
And there's actually, crime here too. I mean.
Oh my goodness. It's more dangerous here than it is in the Middle East.
Interesting.
A thousand times more dangerous.
In terms of gangs and things.
In terms of everything but war.
Interesting.
Everything. Wow. Kidnapping, murder, none of that happens over there. I don't know what the hell.
Even theft and things like
theft,
that.
Theft, drugs, none of it.
Interesting.
So basically what we came when I was, I don't remember anything from that period. If I try to think like my early years, it feels heavy.
Yeah.
But my first non-heavy memory, I don't remember anything before this, was hearing my parents laughing hysterically, making my way into the room when I was maybe 4 or 5. They were watching stand-up. And it was just pure glee.
Dude, you are that you know is exactly my story. My dad laughing to Johnny Carson.
Oh, there you go.
That was the happiest day, part of the day, and I would hear da 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 da, and I'd hear the laughter, pause, laughter, pause,
and that's
laughter.
It.
And then he'd turn the, you know, he'd laugh, 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 and then the TV would go off, poof, you know, and you hear that little sound, and it's such a good memory.
But no matter how bad a day your dad was having,
right? I want that.
At that moment, that was his world. And I remember just connecting with that. And then my parents would record comedy specials on HBO. And there was Dana Carvey. He would host this comedy thing where he'd bring up other comics. And he had this set where he impersonated George Bush Sr. throwing up on the Japanese or Chinese president. And I memorized it.
Aww.
And I would repeat it over and over. And I'd tell everyone when I grow up, I'm going to be either a Ninja Turtle or a stand-up comic.
That's so cute.
Everything I wanted. And then my parents, who were brilliant, encouraged me for reading, and I used to have books. They just leave books around the house.
Yeah, my mom did that. Interesting.
So true. It's such a brilliant way to do it. And then if I was a good boy, they'd be like, we'll take you to the bookstore. You can get anything. Oh. So they take me to the bookstore, and I always buy comics, right?
Yeah.
Because you see comics, and they're cool. And they wouldn't say that that's a bad thing. Just to get me to love. And
Absolutely. My mom used to put Stephen King books around the house, even though they're inappropriate. How are you going to put down Carrie?
Right?
You're not going to put that down.
Or The Stand. I read The Stand when I was like 9. But I go into the bookstore one day and I see a comic strip collection. I must be 7. Of a young boy with a pet tiger. It's called Calvin and Hobbes.
Yeah, sure.
For Bill Watterson. As a child, I see drawings. It's a kid's thing. Not knowing that Calvin and Hobbes is one of the most philosophically brilliant pieces of literature ever written in modern times. So I picked that up. And it was surprising to me many, many years later. And I used to read it all the time. Never understand anything. Just read, read, read. And I remember when I was like 16, I was like, how do I know all these words? How do I have these complex ideas? And I remember when I was like 25, I found my Calvin and Hobbes collection in Beirut. And I'm reading through it. And I'm like, holy shit.
That is so sweet.
Totalitarianism. I learned it from here. This, I learned it from here.
That's beautiful.
So comedy was something that was always ingrained in me.
Okay, but real quick.
From a young age.
So why do you think, though, that, okay, so did you and I steer ourselves toward comedy because we saw our parents laughing and them enjoying it? Or... and we wanted to, you know, enjoy it like them.
Mm-hmm.
Or are we trying to make our parents happy by liking what they like?
No, no, no.
Or validate something
nothing at all.
Nothing like that? Okay.
No, I mean, I'm sure some people might do. I can talk about myself. Maybe you would be different. But for me, I've always had a natural necessity to make everybody around me happy. Not to give them validation. Because I do say and do things that most people don't like. Mm-hmm. But at the end of the road, they find out that it was better. It was always about me making people happy and not knowing how. And then discovering that there's this medium where when I was young, I found that it made people happy. So this is a good thing.
Yeah.
And then in my later years, I started to get into, you know, politics and stuff like that. I became a huge fan of Rage Against the Machine and how activists they were and all of that. And I realized that you could use art to make change. And then it became a natural marrying of the two for my own agenda, which is to change the world.
Wow.
And to stop injustice completely.
That's beautiful.
But it can be done in a non-naive bullshit kind of way.
Have you ever been, though, okay, in the Middle East where you have been in a situation where you didn't feel safe?
Oh,
all the time?
I've put myself in those situations because of what I do, but not all the time, no. But there were situations where there were wars going on, where there were, you know, I've been through maybe 9 different
wars. Yeah, but just because you go through a war doesn't mean you know about guns.
I mean, I've never shot anyone.
Yeah, that's what I mean. You've never held a gun.
No.
Maybe. Yeah, but like, okay, even in my short visit to the Middle East, when I was in Oman, and I was in this souk market,
mm-hmm.
and of course, I am the only blonde there, mm-hmm. and everybody is in jihad. Wait, how do you say it?
Hijab.
Hijab. Or burqa.
Burqa.
And I'm clearly, I stand out.
Yes.
I would get crowded around mm-hmm. in terms of people, especially men,
mm-hmm.
who are, you know, trying to sell me scarves mm-hmm. and silk and things like that. But also looking at me and obviously mm-hmm. like really feeling like I'm getting raped with my eyes. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I never wanted to lose sight of my friend. He had on a red Ferrari hat. And I never wanted to lose sight of that red hat because, you know, I felt moments of like,
fear.
But I kind of thought of that Laura Logan from 60 Minutes when I think she was in Egypt when she as a journalist and she was attacked. And like, I just feel like it, because it's so foreign to me, we don't see men walking around in robes. We don't see people covered. You know, it's just, it's so
it attributes
foreign
to the fear.
Even the language, the letters are different. It's not, you know, of course, it's not Latin. And so there's so much going on. And you also, you feel that things could just turn around in a second right here.
Well, here's the funny thing, though. Just the numbers we use, the 1, 2, 3, 0, 4, all those are called Arab numerals. So it's funny, a lot of people don't know that, but actually the letters that are used by us are actually originally Arab. Not the letters, the numbers, sorry.
Oh, interesting.
So there is a connection. But what you're mentioning is funny. Because of the way PR, this is why my comedy special, I believe, is very important and why I filmed it that way. We were just talking about marrying activism with art. I filmed it in two different places. I paid for it all. It cost me.
Yeah, you have to. As a performer.
But it cost me a lot more to film in two different locations in a way that would make it look like one special. It was very difficult. In Lebanon, it was 5,000 people. In Los Angeles, it was 2,000 people. They were huge productions. But I did it because I figured if we could show two people on different sides of the planet laughing at the same man, at the same jokes, and the joke starts in L.A., lands in Lebanon, comes back here,
if
you can blur, if people can watch the special and feel like they watched one special, then you've achieved a lot.
And I think
it's important because what you're mentioning is so funny to me. Because I know how you felt in Oman.
But you look like those. You look like a person from the Mediterranean region.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you wouldn't feel like that.
No. I mean, I know what you're talking about in Oman because I've been with people who are foreigners. I've had friends come over and visit.
Okay, yeah.
And initially, they all have this fear. And wherever we go, they're like, everybody's looking at me. And I look around, I'm like, they're not looking at you in a negative way. They're looking at you in an intriguing way. And after them being there for a week, you feel so much safer than anywhere else. Now, to contrast it with the story about Egypt, Egypt is under a brutal dictatorship for 35 years. The dictatorship, to keep the people under control, has a massively impoverished population who is incredibly uneducated and just disgusting, vile people. She was in one of the worst areas in Egypt when that happened.
Yeah.
So altogether, yes, Egypt. I can tell you if you said I went to Egypt and I felt that way, I wouldn't be too surprised. That's changing now as they move forward. But if you tell me the Sultanate of Oman, I would be surprised. But you have the right to be feeling that way everywhere. The reason that you're feeling that way is the Arab fault, not the American fault. That's because we haven't done a good job of making people feel safe on first contact. You need to be there for a few days before you're like,
yeah, I believe that.
We had a comic come to Lebanon.
It's like when you go to anywhere.
Anywhere. Obviously. We had a comic come to Lebanon. His name was Godfrey. And he's in the hotel. He calls me the next day. He's like, I can see a tank outside of my hotel. Why is there a fucking tank?
Yeah.
I'm like, no, it's always there. He's like, what do you mean? I'm freaking out. I'm like, I'm coming over. I come over, pull him from the hotel, take him down to the army people at the tank. They're very serious. I go, hello, everybody. They're like, hello. I said, so this is a comic. He's with me. They knew who I was. I'm like, he's from America and he's freaking out about the tanks. And they started laughing. They could come and they speak English. They put him on the tank.
Played so many
and
good tricks.
They let him drive the tank. Oh, and he was just fun. Like, oh, this is the best play.
That's hilarious.
So it's about, you know, it's different. So it feels kind of scary at first, but a lot of the Middle East is not to be feared, actually. It's really much safer than...
Again, the internet has brought us kind of a lot closer, so there isn't as much fear. Listen, speaking about the Sultan of Oman, is he a homosexual?
There is rumors that he's a pedophile, and there's rumors that he's a homosexual, and there's rumors... I have no idea. He's not in the public spotlight at all.
Yeah.
What I do know is what I've heard people say, and what I do know is what I've seen. When I went to Oman, I've been there many, many times. I've seen an incredibly thriving population. I've seen women in burqas at clubs carrying beer and dancing. I've seen 100% tolerance. I've seen people get tickets for not washing their cars in a very clean place. And I've seen a guy who the directive of the Sultan is, we don't want this to be the next Dubai. We want it to stay a secret. He doesn't want there to be too many tourists. He wants to keep the culture. So in his policy, he's done an amazing job.
It was just such a big, like, it was sort of like a taboo thing, and that people could, you know, people to assert that could really get in a lot of trouble.
For sure. I'm
just curious.
But that's what you're in a kingdom.
Right.
You're not in a democracy.
Yeah, it's
you're
kingdom.
In a kingdom.
Yeah,
if, so let's like rewind.
It,
rewind like you're in Spain, right? Imagine you walk out in Spain. You go, the king is a homosexual. You're right. gonna get killed.
Right.
I mean, that's the kingdom, right?
Yeah, I hear
so,
you.
So now you won't get killed. You'll get thrown into prison. But I mean, in Oman, as long as you don't insult the king, you'll live great.
Yeah.
But that's
isn't that interesting?
It's called the Sultanate of Oman.
Hey, listen,
he's
so
the
now,
Sultan.
Yeah,
it's not a democracy.
Now you're in Los Angeles. Now you're in the US and you ran into Barry Katz. How did you guys meet?
So
he's a good friend of the show.
Barry's amazing. Barry is somebody I was a fan of ever since I saw the movie Comedian by Seinfeld. He makes a cameo in it. And he impressed me so much. And I was like, man, I wish I could work with a manager like that one day because I surround myself with people who are brutally honest. And he seemed to be brutally honest. I don't want people who are like, oh, you're the greatest. You're so funny. You're so brilliant. I want somebody who tears me down. I want their experience. I need a mentor. And I never had a manager or an agent in the Middle East. So when I came out here, within 3 months, I was making a lot of noise doing shows in places nobody wanted to do and selling them out. So I'd go to like Lovitz and
Universal, you mean?
Yeah, Universal, mm-hmm. which like was notorious for never selling out and very difficult to get to. And I did a show there with 2 days' notice.
The parking is so difficult.
Parking was – they gave me a day and a half notice. I sold out the show.
How did you sell that
600
out?
I sell out here.
What did you –
that's what I people know me, but I sold out to my crowd, to
great,
people who knew me from the
great.
Middle East.
That's followers.
Followers.
That's
I didn't know.
Fantastic.
I didn't know yet that I didn't have yet an American following. I'm developing that now.
Yeah, that's
amazing. That's what I came to do. So I started making noise. People started talking about me, and you know, word gets around. And then I had a Lebanese friend who was working with Barry, and then she's having dinner with Barry, and Barry's like, and I had just found out the day before that she knew Barry.
Yeah.
And it was just like, and I was like, oh, I love Barry. Maybe one day we could get together. You know, I'm thinking I'll have a dinner with him. And he asked her, he's like, so I've heard about this Lebanese kid apparently going around town. She's like, are you kidding me? It was just like,
oh my gosh.
And she showed him a few of my videos.
See, things are supposed to happen the way they happen. Everything
100%.
There's a reason for everything.
100%. She showed him a few videos. And my videos that I have are a bit interesting. I usually don't put me in them. I have videos where I'll put me maybe one or two, three times maximum. And the rest of it is crowd shots.
Yeah, you do have a lot of crowd shots,
yeah,
actually, because
music.
You play some of these gigs in the Middle East, dude, like 4,000, 5,000, 6,000 people.
Yeah,
and
in like
screaming.
Roman Colosseums and shit. It's dope.
And
it's so cool.
Are like marching back and forth on the stage, and it is like, wow, that must be such a rush.
It is, but I mean, for me, the reason that I don't film me that much is because I never understood how you could market comedy on a joke. Jokes are... in the context, they're subjective. Some people find them funny, some people won't. You're selling a show. So it's not, you can't sell it on a single joke. So we're selling an experience. So for me, it used to be like, I'll do these videos showing what the experience is like to come to one of my shows.
That sounds like a motivational speaker talking.
No, not a motivation. I mean, that's selling. That's marketing 101.
Marketing.
I want you to buy tickets.
Right.
If I'm going to put a joke, the chances of you liking the joke is it decreased my chance of selling you that ticket by about 40% at least, conservatively. You might think it's the funniest joke ever and the person next to you not so much. Now you don't buy tickets.
Right.
But if I show you beautiful people laughing, having a great time, you're going to be more – then you're going to be like, I'm going to get a ticket to this show and I'm going to see some other clips for him.
Yeah.
And then you get more context. So Barry saw that and he didn't actually even see me doing comedy. He just saw that and he's like, his energy and what he's doing is so weird.
That's so smart.
Can
That's
I meet?
Really great.
Let me meet with him. And we met the next day. In the meantime, he did check out my videos.
Yeah.
And then I told him what my aspirations were to change the world. And he said, we can do that. And then we got to work.
He said, yeah, we can do that.
That was Barry.
That's
that
so
was
damn
Barry. Because I told him what I wanted to do. And he said, if that's what you want to do and you're willing to sacrifice to do it because what I want to do has never been done before, then we can do that. But it's based on you. And I said, you'll see. We've been together now for about 2.5 years and we've moved mountains.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
Do you like living in Los Angeles or do you want to go back down to Del Mar or wherever? San Diego?
San Diego's gorgeous.
Yeah.
No, but I live in Venice and Venice is beautiful.
Yeah.
I think if you live in downtown LA, not so much. I'd rather San Diego, but Venice, you know, if you're living on the beach.
Well, downtown LA, as you know, is very hip and very cosmopolitan right now. And
I
mean, it's going up and up.
I just love the beach.
It's like the Manhattanization of Los
Angeles. I agree.
Angeles.
It's gorgeous.
It's really interesting. I'm just saying it's an interesting place, especially a lot of people that are recently divorced live down there. No, I'm just saying it's like very, very hip and single.
Okay.
Then people get married and they move and they move out. But the downtown scene is very, you know, you get
it
yourself
is.
A dog and, you know, things are just like
You just need a dog and
then
things are happening.
And you love the water though, you do?
I love being, I love the beach because you can, what other thing in the world can you go to for free.
I know.
And sit there and immediately have everything taken care of.
Yeah, I love the ocean as well. And I think it has like healing properties.
Really, it does.
You know,
for it does. There's no doubt. I mean, just go watch the sunset. No matter what the hell's going on with you, just sit and let the waves and the sounds and the smells and everything wash over you. And by the time it's done, you'll be okay.
Right on, man. Hey, thank you so much for coming on the show today. I really appreciate
it. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, you're just so interesting, and I could talk to you forever.
Thank you. Likewise. Thank you very much.
All right, you guys. We got to wrap it up right about now. I want to thank you so much for tuning in today. Let Nimmer know that you like his story and tweet him over at Nimmer Comedy. And, of course, follow me over there at Storyworthy. And join us next week for writer-comedian Jason Horton.
My friend and I, my equally perverted 13-year-old friend and I, we're both 13, we're like, we got to get a Playboy magazine.
Don't miss Jason Horton next week on Storyworthy. All right, you guys, I want to thank everybody over at Wondery Media, including Hernan Lopez and Jeffrey Glazer. And on behalf of the talented Nimmer, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
My name is Christine Blackburn, saying, make it a Storyworthy week.
Thanks for joining us on the Storyworthy podcast. We'll be back next week with all new stories. Subscribe to Storyworthy on iTunes and visit the Storyworthy website at storyworthypodcast.com.